Like the show? Want to listen to episodes early? Consider becoming a patron. Starting at the $3 a month level, patrons get access to a custom patron-only feed where we put out episodes of upstairs studio podcasts like the Childcare Bar and Grill, Miss Becky's Classroom, That Early Childhood Nerd, the Renegade Rules podcast, and others early. That feed is just for patrons. You could be one of them. Go to patreon.com/playvolutionhq or click the link in the show description to learn more.
Is Tasha Johnson.
Aloha.
And Josie is here.
Hello.
And Lisa Murphy will be back in a minute. And we've got Andrew Rozak with us from the Institute for Childhood Preparedness for a third episode with Andrew. Andrew, this episode I kind of wanted to talk about just generally risk and danger and hazard. I think in early learning settings, sometimes some programs make all those words mean the same thing, and in some places those words mean different things, but they kind of all go together on some kind of Venn diagram. And so since you kind of work around all of these things in your preparedness work, I thought maybe you could help us kind of define and gain some insight into just this terminology and wrap our heads around it a little bit better. Does that make sense?
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, I think there's a myriad of different things, and we're looking at what are the risks to our program, or what are the dangers to our program, and what are the hazards to our program. And kind of by your very nature, you know, some of these things, like risk, you're going to have the capability and the capacity to control, right? You can mitigate your risks, right? So I was just at a program up in New Jersey in Atlantic City, a Head Start program, beautiful program. It had been completely destroyed by Hurricane Sandy, which we just celebrated. I don't know if celebrated is the right word. We just remembered the seven-year anniversary, so it's been a few years. $22 million Head Start Center that was rebuilt after Hurricane Sandy. And, you know, in those 7 years it took to rebuild the program, they started doing a lot of studies. They redid the flooding maps. They redid a lot of the sea level rise, the erosion, all that kind of stuff. And what they found when they started building, they thought it was going to be okay, but by the time they got done building, the actual flood maps had changed, and the risk to the area of flooding had changed. So they, it was really neat. They've actually installed some really pretty advanced systems where you can actually put barriers in place very quickly, very efficiently to prevent that program from being flooded and being destroyed. So that's a great example of, you know, a risk that's out there and how now we can mitigate that risk by some planning ahead and some investment and some real smart decision making. So these are the kind of things that we're thinking about. Also, you know, if you think about risk from just an employment standpoint, you know, if every time we hire an employee, we inherit some degree of risk, right?
Yeah.
So how do we mitigate that risk? We mitigate that risk through making sure we're doing our mandated background checks and making sure these people are being supervised and all that kind of stuff. So, Jeff, those are just a couple of examples off the top of my head of, you know, how we can take control of risk and
yeah,
lower the risk to our program.
And so, risks can be mitigated. Hazards and dangers, are those different things, or are we using? I mean, are they all the different words for the same thing, or? I've looked at some things, and you know, like OSHA defines a hazard as in one way, and it's kind of, it's like a hazard is a potential risk, and so there's I don't know, I'm just kind of up in the air about these terms and the way programs use them, and so are hazards and dangers different than risk, or what are your thoughts?
Well, I think it is pretty wide open, as you've mentioned, and I think it depends on the discipline that you're looking from, what lens you're looking at, how you're going to define this stuff, right? So If you're talking about a hazard from a public health or even a fire department standpoint, a hazard is something that occurs, maybe naturally, such as, let's just talk about mold, right? So mold occurs, it's a hazard. We don't want mold in our buildings. We spend 93% of our life indoors. A lot of time inside.
It's a lot of time
inside. It's kind of depressing. That's a risk.
If you look at the amount of hours that a child spends just in early learning in elementary school, it's over 20,000 hours they spend inside a child care program or a school. That's over 833 days. It's crazy. And we're seeing this right now in our recovery work in the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico. The indoor environments, in many cases, they aren't as healthy. And in some cases, studies have shown that they're, five to seven times more unhealthy than just being outside in the open air. Now you take that, you compound that with some of the floodings that has occurred and some of the lack of maintenance. I'd encourage your listeners to ponder, when is the last time you had your vents from your air conditioner or heater system clean? There can be a lot of nasty stuff living in those air vents. And kids with asthma certainly are going to experience the consequences of those, what we would say, are a hazard. Same thing with pests, right? What happens after a severe weather event? The screens get blown out, and that allows vectors to come in, whether those are mosquitoes that may be carrying Zika or other, dengue or other diseases. And it also allows rats and rodents to come in. So those are definitely hazards we need to look at and mitigate as well. So I guess, again, depending on the discipline you're coming from, some would say that you can control risk, but you can't control hazards. Someone can say that a hazard, when it gets to a certain degree, then it is considered a danger. But it really, I think, depends on kind of where your training's coming from or what lens you're looking through on these terms.
Andrew, after talking, this is our third episode with you, and it seems like you deal with all the nasty stuff nobody wants to think about or deal with. You're dealing with shooters and tornadoes and fires and drills and hurricanes and mold and pests and this.
Oh my!
Do you ever get exhausted and downtrodden about how much of how potentially?
That's actually a very valid question, and I'm going to add something to that, Andrew. Before you respond, do you find that you have to kind of keep yourself in check because you are in a position probably to see a hazard danger probably everywhere you look. So how do you keep that in balance so you're not over responding?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I really credit a lot to back in my firefighter and paramedic training. I've seen a lot of bad stuff. I mean, people are not usually calling 911 because it's the best day of their life.
911, we bake cookies for you.
That
doesn't happen very often.
I've actually been on many scenes. I was awarded Firefighter of the Year for saving a couple kids out of a burning building and bringing them back to life and just all sorts of crazy experiences. But I approach these with a different lens. I approach it as someone who's very fortunate to be in the position I'm in and to be there with hopefully a way to help people. And that's kind of always been my approach. I think the key is it's not my emergency. It's not my disaster. And if you don't get kind of sucked into that emotional state, I think that can help. I mean, I'm luckily I've got the training both, formally and just from life experience to come into these situations with a calm head and try to start formulating a plan of, okay, here's the problem. How do we get ourselves out of this problem? And what resources do we really need to bear?
You've done lots of reps.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's that's a learned skill. I mean, I don't think that's for everybody, and certainly working down in the Florida Keys and helping those folks recover and rebuild, and then the 2 years we've been on island in Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands, it really is a humbling experience. But at the end of the day, it's a really good feeling to know that you're helping and you're leaving folks in a better place than where they were when they first met you.
So Andrew, well, we've got you. We've talked in a previous episode. We talked about active shooter training and drills, and we've talked about
preparedness, and we talked about bigger things like tornadoes and fires and that kind of stuff. I was wondering if you could give me some thoughts on just general walking around every day in an average early learning program, what dangers, risks, hazards might be there that we might not be paying attention to. Back in my center director days, one of our licensors that I worked with, great guy, Roger, he always said when he came to visit that he was a fresh set of eyeballs in the building. Because, you know, I'm there every day and not seeing things that I don't notice things, again, situational awareness that he might see coming in with fresh eyeballs. So when you walk through an average program or average playground, what are the things your eyeballs are seeing that the average caregiver or director or program owner might not be seeing?
Yeah. I think that's great. And I was just at a program in Wichita, Kansas. And one of the first things I noticed was that their dumpster was in a really awkward position. It was kind of in the corner of their parking lot, but real close to their fence, and it really would provide a spot where someone could hide behind and ambush you, or they could easily climb on top of that dumpster and then climb right over the fence, and now they're into your playground area. Mm-hmm. So I just said, you know, hey, maybe the next time the garbage people come out, can you ask them to put the dumpster back on the other side of the parking lot so that you're not having to walk, you know, next to it every single day as you're coming in and out of work? And also it's more open that way. If someone is trying to, you know, hide behind it, you can see them.
And the guy said
the same thing. He said, I've worked here for 17 years. I've walked by that dumpster every day. I never even thought about it. But, you know, these are the kind of things with a fresh set of eyes. And especially now, as we think about going into fall and winter, we have a lot of folks that are going to work in the morning when it's dark and they're leaving work when it's dark.
Yeah.
So those simple things of, you know, walking around the parking lot, making sure the lights that are burned out are replaced in a timely manner. If your staff's going to be working late, get them and move their cars closer to the building so they're not walking through a vacant parking lot. You know, go with the buddy system if you can when you go outside. These are the kind of real simple things that we can do, again, to make ourselves safer. From the inside of the building perspective, you know, we always see a lot, there's always a lot of concern and question about like integrated pest programs, right? So making sure that our childcare programs do not have pests is a really good thing, because pests bring disease, pests can trigger asthma, you don't want them there. But we also know that children operate a lot differently than adults. And one of the ways that they do that is they spend a lot more time lower to the ground or on the floor, depending on the age of the kids. So studies have shown that the chemical concentrations at ground level can be anywhere from 4 to 6 times more potent than they can where a normal adult is walking around at 5 or 6 feet in the air. And that's because chemicals traditionally weigh more than air, more than oxygen, and they sink to the ground. So, you know, making sure you have in place policies that you're not using. I see so much bleach being thrown around. I mean, we're throwing around a lot of bleach, guys. And bleach is great,
yes,
but we got to be using the proper ratios, the 1 to 10,000, 1 to 1,000, these kind of things for our disinfecting and our sanitizing. The other thing I see, quite honestly, Jeff, is I see a real lack of understanding between those two terms. What is sanitizing and what is disinfecting? So the purpose of sanitizing is anything that we're going to be putting in our mouth, right? So whether it's a spoon, a fork, a knife, a bottle, we want to sanitize that. Now, that takes a lower level of bleach to sanitize versus what we would consider to be a disinfectant. A disinfectant is any time that we come into contact with body fluids. So if you've got a changing table, if you're dealing with vomit, if you're cleaning the bathroom, we want to be disinfecting those surfaces. That's going to kill the germs and the viruses and the fecal matter and all that kind of stuff. This is the sanitization, which is a little bit of a lower threshold. So that a lot of uncertainty about just kind of those simple health practices that can really keep it, especially as we think about now going into the winter and what looks to be potentially a pretty bad flu season.
Oh, good. Good. Well, you brought it to the bright side, Andrew. Yeah. And it always bugged me when we have the guy come in with from the exterminators and the spraying and stuff. And so it's something you kind of got to do. And you kind of, I mean, I guess they're trying to build safer mixtures. And then I thought, oh, maybe we'll put down glue traps instead. But, you know, the last thing you want is a 9-month-old with 14 glue traps stuck to him crawling across the playroom floor, because that's a problem waiting to happen too. So,
I'll say from the environmental health perspective, we'd rather you have the glue traps because that's catching the animal. That's, you know, going to be a lot safer. You're not introducing chemicals, because what happens too often is you put the chemicals down, or the rat pills, and the rats will eat them, and then they'll hide somewhere and die, right? Yeah. So now you've got poison on the floor, you've got a rat that's ingested poison, and now you've got a dead decaying carcass somewhere.
Nice!
Yeah, the rat traps are much better. The live glue traps are much better in that situation.
Yeah, it's just, you got to make sure you get them placed in the right place. And oh, and when they get stuck on there, and then they don't, they take so, it's, yeah, it's delightful. any thoughts on playgrounds, Andrew? Fall zones, and one thing that really bugs me is this rubber matting that they're going to. And yes, it's usually black or dark colored, and it heats up. And even these plastic slides, the way they heat up, we've spent some time over in Australia doing trainings and stuff. And, you know, some programs, they don't have the shade sails above the playgrounds. You know, 3/4 of the year, kids aren't going on the stuff because they're burning themselves. And so what are your thoughts there?
Yeah, and let me just say, so if you want to do sanitizing, that's 1 tablespoon of bleach per 1 gallon of water. If you want to do disinfecting for things like vomit and poop and all that kind of stuff, that's 1 tablespoon of bleach per 1 quart of water, or 1/4 cup of bleach for a gallon of water. So those should be the limits that we're using.
Keep it safe.
On the playground, you're 100% right. And I don't know if you were creeping on our Facebook, but you may have seen a video from the Virgin Islands I posted not too long ago. Well, we have a heat gun, and we're out on the playgrounds with the heat gun. And these temperatures are, as you know, routinely 120, 130, 140 degrees. That can be very unsafe for kids. And I know, because I've replaced them in hurricane-prone areas, how much these darn shade structures cost. But my goodness, to go from 140 degrees on that slide and bring it down to a much more manageable 80 or 90 degrees, you know, thinking about your risk long term, I'd much rather invest that money in a shade structure that's going to provide a lot of benefit than have to spend that money in a lawsuit because some kid has now got, you know, second or third degree burns because they got stuck on my slide, right?
Yeah, yeah. Any thoughts on playground surfacing or fall zones or that kind of stuff, or is that kind of outside your scope of
So it's amazing how expensive that is, first off. I had no idea.
Oh, yeah.
And, I was working in the Florida Keys after was it Hurricane Irma. All the hurricanes kind of run together at this point. I think it was Irma. And was looking. We had a lot of devastation. I was working with a child care program there, a couple of them, to get their surfaces redone. And, oh, my goodness, I couldn't believe the cost, first off. There is some emerging science. It's been published in a couple journals. We're still waiting for some more scientific reviewed and peer-reviewed journals. But we're starting to see now is some of this stuff, especially the ground tires, you know, that is becoming so prevalent.
Yeah.
Which is understandable because they take the tires, they grind them up, it's cheap, and it, you know, in theory cushions you. But there's been some studies that have been done looking at soccer players or football players if you're in Europe. And there seems to be some kind of, potentially, some kind of stages, early stages of a link between the goalkeepers and cancer when they're playing on these surfaces. So it's still controversial in the community. Again, we're waiting for more science and research to come out. But it seems to me that the goalkeepers who are routinely picking up the soccer ball and being exposed to these ground pellets and all the kind of stuff that we have, it seems like some of the early research is suggesting there may be some cancer-causing agents there, which I don't think is a real shock to anybody. And those rubber tires, crying out loud, right? So
yeah,
I do kind of worry about that. And I think, you know, gosh, if these are adult males that are generally pretty healthy being athletes, what is this doing to the kid who's, you know, just starting their development cycle and they're crawling around and, you know, getting into all this stuff? So I think that's something we need to keep an eye on. The other thing I think is going to be an emerging issue is the cell phone towers, especially as we start to erect more and more towers to cover 5G in the United States.
Yeah.
It's very tempting to come and sign one of these agreements and get this monthly income where you're essentially renting your roof or your back of your yard to a cell phone tower. I am a little bit worried about what are these radio waves doing to our kids? Is that going to be something that's going to come back to haunt us long term as well? So I think those are kind of two emerging issues. We probably need to keep our eye on those as well.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I mean, the idea of 5G, part of me can't wait, but I've read that maybe it's something we need to be a little bit more concerned about as they start rolling it out. So for the time being, we don't put those towers up on our playgrounds for the time being. And then we'll go to Lisa Murphy, who has her hand up. Go ahead, Lisa.
Oh, I was wondering if there's anything that you'd like to tell us that we can calm down about. You know, like I appreciated the tour, and I was actually glad that Jeff asked what he just did, like take us on a little quick walk through a center. What are some of the things we could be looking for? What in your experience are we overreacting to that we can calm down about?
Huh, that's a good question.
Is it, the answer might be, well, no, actually. but I think, and maybe I'm asking from the lens of, I just hear so much concern about some things that I'm like, you know, is it really that big of a deal? And I'm just wondering if you've seen anything that, you know, in your expert opinion, we could like just take a chill pill about.
Well, that's a tough one. I'm going to have to get some thoughts about that. That's been coming to the top of my mind. You know, I think it's been kind of interesting. A lot of the stuff that's been kind of taking up a lot of my time and attention is your traditional, I guess what we would consider just to be environmental health challenges. I mean, it's things like food safety and making sure that you're preparing food in a way that's appropriate and cooking food to proper temperatures. You know, we have a whole host of programs that get food delivered off-site, right? They'll prepare it in the central kitchen and deliver it. And I'm always a little concerned about just the holding temperatures for these items. We have some really unique stuff in the Virgin Islands. We have a whole system of cisterns. And cisterns are essentially big, let's just call them underground swimming pools that are big pools of water. And they, instead of the rain going down your gutters and running out your yard, the rain goes down your gutters and into these big holding tanks. And then they use the water for, you know, showering, for flushing toilets, for, you know, cooking and cleaning and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, normally it works pretty well. It's been working well for, you know, years and years and years. But what we saw in the aftermath of the hurricanes is we have a lot of debris and a lot of stuff that's being introduced into these cisterns. And we actually had a few folks die of leptospirosis, which is a waterborne disease that gets into tainted water. So those, you know, the water quality is going to become, I think, a pretty big issue. And these are not things that are fixed in a short period of time. I mean, for crying out loud, look what's still going on in Flint, Michigan. Look what's happening in New Jersey. We have infrastructure in this country that is over 300 years old. I mean, they're 200, 300 years old. Here in Washington, D.C., the pipes are well over 200 years. And if you think about every mile that we have of interstate highway in the country, every mile of interstate highway that we have, there's a lot. We have 26 times that many miles in water pipes. I mean, it's just astronomical. It's astronomical, right? So, and we know these things are breaking on an everyday basis. Mm-hmm. Basically, the way the water system's working right now in the United States is that for every 7 gallons that's delivered through a water system, we lose 1 gallon. So every 7 gallons that goes down the pipe at the end, we only get 6 gallons. I mean, that's how much water we're losing because of this infrastructure failure. So I was just in Newark doing some training, and it was sad to see just, you know, all the places that needed to be on bottled water. And I'm really worried that we're not getting the word out to the parents. And this was at a Head Start program I was at. And of course, Head Start is a program that, you know, deals especially with low-income families. Mm-hmm. And I'm worried that they're not having the resources and the support needed to get access to the clean drinking water. And we know how important clean drinking water is to newborns, especially as we're making formula and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, those are kind of the things that get me a little bit worried about. And I just hope that in our messaging, we're actually reaching the target audiences and letting them know that, hey, if there's lead in the water, you can boil it all day long. That's not going to get the lead out.
Any other thoughts, everybody, around risk, hazards, dangers, and early learning settings before we let Andrew go?
We're good. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, now we're all kind of in panic mode now.
hey Andrew, wash my hands.
Andrew, I got to tell you, these episodes we recorded with you have been great for me. We were talking about real, I mean, it's real serious stuff that it could be kind of depressing and sad to talk about, but you approach it with a kind of upbeat, can-do, let's solve the problem attitude. And I really appreciate that. And I thank you for your time. Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap this episode up?
Well, I just think that, you know, hey, this is a community. We need to learn from each other. We sadly have had a lot of our community members that have went through some really hard times lately. But there's light at the end of the tunnel. Now, it could be, you know, a year, it could be 2 years, it could be 5 years, depending on how long the recovery is going to take. But it offers a really unique opportunity. It's not every day that you get to rebuild an early childhood program essentially from scratch. So the challenge here is not, you know, how do we rebuild them exactly the way they were before the tragedy struck? The challenge is here, how do we take this opportunity that in many cases is going to be once in a lifetime and really infuse the latest research and evidence to get these centers even be above and beyond where they were so that we're not just rebuilding back to what it was, we're rebuilding back much better so that we can incorporate these best practices, right? So space and designing and furniture and table sizes and heights and you know, interactive spaces and all this kind of stuff, that's really important. So that's always kind of been my messaging too. Like, yes, this is a tragedy. I'm really, really sorry it happened, and I 100% feel for you, but I'm also here for you. We're going to get through this together, and at the end of the day, we hope to come out of this experience a lot better than we were before we went into it, for us and for the kids that we're going to serve. So that's what gives me hope, and that's what that keeps me going, and I really appreciate the time to chat to you and all the great work you guys do. I mean, as part of the community, the podcasts are great to get, you know, the latest research and evidence and thoughts and really – expand on the conversation. So thank you for making the podcast, and I hope you keep continuing to do so.
We appreciate it, Andrew. Thank you for your time. Andrew's with the Institute for Childhood Preparedness. Childhoodpreparedness.org is the website. If you Google childhood preparedness, I'm going to guess Andrew's going to come up in the top of the results. Good SEO over there. Andrew, thank you for your time. Thank you for your insight. Thank you for your experience and knowledge. And thank you on behalf of all of the early learning profession. Thank you for your hard work in this corner of it. Thanks for tuning in, people. This has been the Child Care Bar and Grill. We'll be back soon with another episode. Bye-bye.
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 This has been an Explorations Early Learning Upstairs Studio production.